We are in Champions League, man.
That was my
dilly din, dilly don. Come on.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
This is the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast with Gary Kernin.
Aguero!
Hello, welcome to the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. My name is Gary Kernin. Joining us this week is Chris Ramsey, one of the leaders in coach player development over the last 10, 15 years, working at Tottenham, recently at QPR. He's also worked for the England national team setup, and he's also worked at the Charleston Battery in the USL back in 2001 through to 2004. So we talk a little bit about that, but we talk a lot about player development. We talk a lot about environments. I love this conversation. I've been trying to get Chris on the podcast for a long, long time. So as you can tell, I was really, really excited to get him on. Brilliant chat. Hope you enjoy it. If you do, please spread the word to your coaching community. Please give it a share on your social media platforms. A huge thanks to all the coaches that jumped on the MSC game model webinar last week. It's now available to download the replay. 2 hours where we go through the game model, how to build it, and then also have a customizable template for coaches who sign up and register. So you can get your copy, modernsoccercoach.com/shop. Again, appreciate all the support. Here is Chris. Enjoy. Chris, thanks so much for joining me on the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. Really, really excited to have you on.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me. It's an honor to be on.
I'm going to ask the first question about your playing background. A lot of coaches are influenced by, you know, their playing experiences. I actually didn't know you played in the 83 Cup final last night. I stuck it on YouTube last night, right back against Stapleton and Whiteside.
Yeah, and Arnold Muren and people like that.
How did that shape your kind of coach philosophy that we talk about today?
Listen, my coach philosophy wasn't really just my playing career. My playing career obviously allowed me to see pitches on the pitch that more quickly than had I not. You know, I'm not saying that everybody has to play. But I think it's important that people play at some level, whether it be in the park or whether it be international level. I think it's easier to see pitches once you've been on the pitch. Now, most of my initial love for the way football was played came from, obviously, the Brazil team in the 1970 final. You know, it's my first World Cup that I saw in colour. It was one of the first ones. And then I'm an Arsenal supporter as well, the double winning team. And then, funny enough, it was just as young as back as the 1974 World Cup final versus Germany versus Holland. And I think from you know, I always look back to that and the way the Dutch played, the interaction, and then Franz Beckenbauer, he was one of my favourite players as well. So it develops from there, to be honest with you. And then obviously I didn't coach really properly till I was about 28.
And that was a natural progression from playing.
Yeah, no, I wasn't actually going to be a coach. I couldn't ever see myself being a coach. I was a pretty rebellious type of character when I was a player. And the last person that anybody would think would be a coach was me. And I had a bad injury, and I ended up going to Malta to play in Malta. And just by coincidence, the manager got the sack. And I was one of the foreign players that was earning more money than anybody else. And the owner said, right, you're gonna have to coach the team. And I had two great friends there, Ray Ferrugia and Paul Sixsmith. Paul played at Man United in the Beckham youth team, and Ray Ferrugia, he ended up being the national team coach. They were in my team, and they actually helped me a lot to coach. But player coach was probably the hardest job I've ever had, if I'm being honest.
I mean, there's so much to get into. I actually didn't know you were an Arsenal fan, so...
Oh,
Let's talk about Tottenham. So let's talk about, I'm fascinated by coaching environments, and we do so much on player development, and we try to talk about coach development as a pathway, and improving and self-development. A lot of coaches are in isolated environments, but that Tottenham environment produced, I was over there, and I'm sure you'd already met you briefly about 10 years ago, and I spent a couple of hours with Kieran McKenna. And I remember all the coaches that were there, and it was a who's who almost of over the last 10 years of impact at the top level of the English game. What was it about that environment from a coaching standpoint that you think drove that quality forward?
Well, John McDermott, I worked with there. I came over back from Florida to be his assistant, and we'd worked before together at the FA, and we'd always been an advocate of development of players and individual development and how players actually impact a team as an individual. And where you are as a coach, what are you actually trying to achieve? I mean, I'd obviously, before that, I'd been influenced a lot as well by Ricky Hill, who was at Cocoa Beach. And FIT, and obviously he's been at Tampa, and he's his assistant at Luton. But me and John had always talked about individual development of players, because when you actually look at a game now, a lot of it is people talk about tactics, but most goals are mistakes or bits of magic. So we created an environment there where we really focus on making sure that the individual got the best possible coaching, the best possible understanding of their character and their strengths, and how we can build their strengths into super strengths. And we were fortunate that we had, you know, some good disciples. You know, we had, obviously Alex Inglethorpe came in there, and he was fantastic as well. You see what he's done at Liverpool, and Richard Allen was fantastic on the recruitment, which brought the players in to help us coach a good standard of player. And then we had, you know, Perry Sutkin, he was there. He was actually the advocate, not the advocate, but he was the catalyst really for everything, because the keeper's playing out from the back, and he was very good with that. So there was a good initial cohort of people there that followed what we wanted to do. And then obviously we brought in people like Ozzy Abanji, Danny Buck, Bradley Adam was there as well. So he'd seen a lot of different things going on there, you know, through the years. And you know, it's always difficult when there's a change, but he bought into what we were doing. So there was a lot of good people there. If you think Dan Machichi, who's at Everton now, and he coached England, and he was the manager at MK Dons, you know, there's such a cohort of coaches that have gone there, but you all got to be on a similar page, you know. And obviously Kieran, and you've got Matt Wells there now as well. Matt Wells is first team coach there, but he was Scotty Parker's assistant. And Kieran, obviously, John mentored him. So the environment of everybody pushing everybody and everybody trying to understand what creates an individual that can go into a team was the thing that most helped us to help the players become better. And one of the main things is that people got to realize is that a youth team doesn't go into a first team. So most people are part of the journey, part of the vehicle, and where their career ends up is probably not going to be at your club in the first team. If you can get one out of every youth team, you've done brilliant. But to understand that you've got an obligation to the players as individuals, an obligation to make sure that they reach their potential regardless of where they end up, is what drove us really.
Brilliant, brilliant. Speaking of individuals that may break into that level, which is the smallest percent of a percent, obviously Harry Kane's journey, the going lower leagues and going back and getting different experiences, but also, again, I was on Wikipedia last night just refining the research, and I looked at that you coached in the 99 England under 20 team. And I was saying, oh, I wonder who was in that there. And you had a Peter Crouch, centre forward.
I was fortunate that year, or those years, when I joined the FA, I had a steep learning curve. I was Howard Wilkes' assistant, and then in and then I was Les Rees' assistant in the under-16s in the Euros. So I've been fortunate to work with some good people there. You know, Kenny Swains, Martin Hunter, Steve Ratta, Paul Smalley's, people like that who were in there. But two of the biggest influences for me was Dick Bate. He was absolutely outstanding mentor for me, and Craig Simmons. So when I look at the people that I've actually been exposed to, it's been monumental for me. And I worked with some good people. You know, in that under-18s team that year, we had Steve Gerrard, Ashley Coles, Leddy Kings, just people like that. You know, that you go through, and it's a who's who. So I've been really fortunate to be involved in that, and as a young coach there as well, I learned so much. You know, you look back now and you put your hands over your face and think, you know, what was I doing? But you know, it was an invaluable experience for me. So all those things add to your journey.
Whenever that philosophy around, you mentioned there about you and John McDermott, about that individual and getting that individual through, and that individual has to be like something that I've saw in the research that I've done and some of your work has been that it's not defined on a system, so it's defined on a skill set,
on a style.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, what we look at is, first and foremost, every job has a job description. So the higher up you go, the more refined your job becomes. If you're a centre half and you can't stop the turn or you can't head the ball, you're not going to be one. But what we try and do is ensure that the players, when they first, we talk about the bottom of the pyramid, which is extreme technique. So if you are an extremely technical player, then it's down to how do you understand movement, and how do you understand any philosophy that you've been put into. So there's different things, obviously physical capabilities come into it as well, but that's where as a coach you have to understand what someone has to offer physically and emotionally. So all those things put into the pot, but mainly we try to make sure that they maximize their level of technique. So we don't want, you know, how many times do you hear when people say someone's got a good touch for a big man? You know, we don't want that. What we want is people that can play in good possession football, but plus have an individual ability to screen the ball, to stay on the ball, to use different bits of advanced core skills to create problems for the other team, and also get out of individual problems themselves. So most of the time, it isn't based on a system. What we want is players that can play for different managers, so they can play in different systems. They have a good game understanding, and they have the techniques to play in the system or the philosophy that they find themselves in.
Is that a lot of supplemental work alongside the technical? Is that, I remember when I was there, it was at Tottenham. I believe there was a 15 or 20 minutes where the players had their own time after sessions at younger age groups. Is it little things like that there that you implement?
Yeah, because I think sometimes experimentation is generally where people can make unpressured mistakes, can try things, because there's things that you can't teach the kids, and you have to also realize what they bring to the party. So sometimes you have to allow them to try little knuckleball shots or little touches that are in their own personal DNA. And the last thing you want to do is try and coach that out of them, unless it's something that's going to stop them moving forward, obviously. So I think it's always important. Sometimes people look at my sessions and they think that they're messy or unstructured, but they're actually more structured, because you know what you're trying to achieve by allowing people to have the freedom, especially young players, the freedom to experiment. And during that experimentation is probably where most of the learning happens, or a lot of the learning happens.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because we're at a time now where there's a lot of, even Argentina, like Scolari's talked about it, about coaching out of players, coaching that creativity out of players. Do you see that in an era of a little bit more pre-professional, sciencey era that we're currently in?
Well, the problem is, I think people don't realise that all the stats and the science was there before. It just wasn't as glossy. But what it is now is it's so easily accessible that people look at things probably more in a square box, clean, than they actually understand. I mean, for argument's sake, you watched the game on Saturday, Saturday or Sunday, Liverpool versus Man United. Fantastic game. Everybody says a fantastic game. Just talking about this with John the other a couple of days ago. I was saying it's a fantastic game because the defending was poor. And there was a lot of scruffy finishing, you know, people finishing on the turn quickly, you know, and stuff like that. Hardly any of the goals were planned goals that you would say you can go and work on. Or we talk about tactics. We talk about low block, high press. You know, lots of the times people don't they just say it and expect people to know it. People do a lot of things happens. People are a lot more just functional players. There's a lot of just functional players now who are, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying they're not technically good, but they're part of a cog. They're just a cog in a machine. Now, generally, unless you're a high level cog, you're probably not going to go any further because you're just somebody who's can play in a team, but can't play in another team because you learn systems of play rather than the ability to maneuver the ball, pass the ball, create bits of magic. Or even if you're a defender, what if you're a fullback, what are your passes, essential passes? You know, we're talking about hitting the seven, hitting the nine, hitting the channel, hitting the midfield player. You know, we're talking about, do people actually look at that and say, right, these are the essential passes for this position? If you're a 10, what sort of 10 are you? Are you a 10 that comes off the nine and plays? Are you a 10 that runs in behind? Are you a midfield 10 that sits in front of the two or the three midfield players? What type of 10 are you? You know, so people look at a system of play and says, right, we need this type of 10 or this type of nine. Now, unless you've got money to go out and actually prescriptively buy that for a first team, then what you're doing is letting the kids down because you're not taking into consideration who's in front of you. So lots of times people, they play the game and they think, right, if we can play this pretty game of football, which has gone too much the other way now. I know before we were very direct and it was all for one and everybody getting stuck in and it was ugly. But in the end, both have the same outcome because if you're just a cog in a pretty game of football, you got to think to yourself, where are most players likely to play? Most players are not playing in the top half of the Premiership. Most players are playing in the rest of the league where it's roll your sleeves up on a windy day. And can you now have that ability to play in the hustle and bustle and still be able to express yourself? So one of the things that we try to do, we try to get people prepared for the eventualities of not being in a top six team, not being in a top six program. You know, they have to be able to do both. So it's very important that you try to get the players to understand that game understanding with their technique and movement is probably what's going to get them to where they need to be.
Hello, coaches. We'll take a quick break here. If you missed the MSC Designing Your Game Model webinar last week, you can get a replay of it available on the Modern Soccer Coach website, modernsoccercoach.com/shop. Available now. All coaches will receive a customizable game model template that you can edit and modify to suit your own team and your own principles and your own values. A two-hour webinar. We go through philosophy and values. We go through principles. I explain the principles that I would use in my game model. We also look at training methodology and we also look at how to align that with analysis and review processes as well. 2 hours plus the game model template as well. Available now on modernsoccercoach.com/shop.
I saw one of your presentations that I believe you did over the lockdown, and it was player development, almost principles, but you were saying about attacking player, very simple. Can they score? Can they create? And I believe it was progress possession or deal with the ball. In today's world, database, but like it just struck me as the simplicity of, if you're going to make it at the next level, you would need to be really, really effective at those three things.
Well, the thing is, Lambs, is we have four things in and out, and we have the glue. So four things in, can you score? Can you create? Can you maintain possession, or can you get something out of it? Now, obviously, the young ones, we're not saying that. Then on the other side, You're looking at can you win it? Can you make play predictable? Can you support the first defender? What's your team function? So most players, most of the time, are in maintain possession and team function. Because you only touch the ball between a minute and 2 minutes in a game. So most time you're going to be in those two things. So on those sides. And it's at any time understanding where you are on the pitch and which one of those four things in or out of possession that you're at. Now the glue to it is people understanding what's going on around the ball, on and around the ball. What's your movement? What's your timing? What's your execution? So to give you an example, if you are an attacking player on the other side of the wing, and on the left wing and on the right wing, you have a winger who's got the ball, right? So how deep is he? Where's he going to cross it to? Is he ready to cross? What's his body language like? So is there somebody running around him? So you make your runs based on all those initial processes that you're talking about. Now, as soon as you compute what's going to happen, you start moving. What's your movement? Are you running on the back of the furthest defender? Are you running behind him? Or are you going to try and run in front of him? Once you've decided that based on what you think is going to happen, when the cross comes in, now you've got tempo. What's your timing? Is it quick? Is it slow? How do you get there? And then what's your execution? Are you heading it? Are you volleying it? What bat are you using? Are you setting it? So that happens in every execution on the pitch. So getting coaches to try and understand that these are the things that individuals need to be aware of when they're on the pitch, of how they're actually going to perform, rather than reacting to something with no cleverness and just hoping that they can use their physicality to out-muscle somebody. So if you look at someone like, if you look at a lot of youth football where the bigger players score and nobody really coaches them, and until they get to a level where everyone's on a similar physical basis, they've got no cleverness, no moves, no dark arts. But you look at some big players like a Duncan Ferguson, even Les Ferdinand, Peter Crouch, Haaland now, they all had dark arts and movement and craft in their movement. Alan Shearer, big player, big and strong player, but got craft in their movement. So that helps their power and strength for them to execute what they need.
See when you almost reverse engineer that, then you go back to what you're saying there about the older, more physically advanced player that's going to stand out at the youth level. Should coaches be spending more time challenging those types of players that are getting by on their physical qualities?
No, what they should be doing is teaching them what they teach the others, and everyone will find the level that they are. So if they accelerate, then you should have another page to teach them more. So everybody learns the similar thing, but they eat the diet that they like, don't they? So the people who if you're a small player and you're a centre forward, you might be one that ducks in front. So it's still running to the near post, but how you run to the near post, it might suit you different. You as a coach has to quickly, I talk about the zone of proximal development, which is the challenge point. Where is that player on there? Where can you challenge them to get better? And then if sometimes we go too far ahead, we teach people things that they're not ready to learn. And a lot of coaches don't want to teach simply kicking the ball. They don't want to teach that. I remember Les and Tim, Les Ferdinand and Tim Sherwood, when they came and joined the clubs, the development squad, which was an extension of the academy. And they totally bought into what we were doing there. And they added based on their experience and their international experience and the level that they'd been at. So they added to the players, and they were developers as well. So they helped develop the players that came out of the academy. And it was just little things about how you strike the ball, about your back lift on the ball, stuff like that. When you're shooting as a forward, as a midfield player, how you use your body and stuff like that. Now, these are not things I'm saying we didn't teach. as a younger age, but you can then you have to move it to the next level where players can actually take it into the league football and play against their peers.
That piece as well, you talked about play where you are was one of the principles. Is that what you're saying about the player having to compute quickly to make that 30-second opportunity that comes in the middle of the game? That's part of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about now with fullbacks rolling inside and all this. Well, what I'm talking about is we added, the rotation part of the game, which is what I not me only. It's not, you know, obviously this was developed by a team of people, but what I really liked about the Dutch teams back in the day when they used to interact. I don't know if you ever see Germany versus Holland, the World Cup final. If you go and look at it, Johan Cruyff ends up as the sweeper, receiving the ball before he runs with it.
When he won the penalty?
Ends up as a sweeper and he runs with it. But you look at the centre-halves out wide, the full-backs are tucked inside, this and that and the other. So what it is if you have good technique and you have game understanding, like even playing the little boxes, what they call rondos now, but they're playing the little boxes. If you can play five-a-side, you can play anywhere on the pitch. So it means if you can quickly interchange and emerge somewhere, create overloads quickly because you're not worried about stepping into midfield and playing there as a centre half or what they call it, holding midfield player now, or whatever it might be. It means that if the ball breaks down, you don't need to run back 20, 30 yards because of the rotations. Your space should be filled in. Someone else should fill your space in. So it means you end up as a winger and you end up, the two's gone past you and crosses it and hits the first man, you should be able to run back and fill his space or her space. You should be able to do that. And then for 30, 60 seconds, while the play is going on, the other player fills your space. And if the ball goes over the other side, you should know as that number seven that you have to tuck over. You should just know that. The ball's gone inside me because I'm the number seven. I don't know. I didn't know what to do. Now, you might not be the expert playing there, but you know for that 30 seconds or 60 seconds, you're playing as a fullback to the best of your ability. So that people understanding that 30 to 60 second window is really, really important in movement and overloads and creating the elements of surprise where you have people emerging onto the scene. Now, the other day, I don't know if you saw it, Tottenham were playing somebody and they went 2-for-2 at the back. Now, one of the things about creating massive overloads is getting people, not overloads, but elements of surprise, because there's no overloads really, because at the end of the day, it's 10 versus 10 on the pitch. So if people can go 1v1 and mark, then you're always going to have extra players because lots of teams like cover, don't they?
Yeah.
So people don't want to go 1v1. We teach cover, which is great, but people don't want to do that, do they? What they want to do is they always want to know that they've got that safety net behind them. Now, I don't understand that myself, but one of the things that we used to work a lot with the defenders was about people being able to do the stuff on their own. Because in the end of the day, it's 1v1 when it boils down to it. So you think about it. If you have a corner and they leave one person up, the other team would always leave two people back. Now, I challenge you this. Do a drill where the goalkeeper picks the ball up and you put a defender, no one else on the pitch, an empty pitch. You have a goalkeeper each end of an 11-a-side pitch. And get the goalkeeper to catch it and just kick it as long as he can. How many times will the forward score? Probably would never score, would he? He'd never score. So therefore, we're saying, well, it's a 1v1 and the keeper's got to kick it 60 yards. He's got to bring it down and beat the flatter and beat the keeper and get the ball on target. Doesn't happen, does it? It wouldn't happen if you did it in a drill.
Well, just on that, what was your thoughts on the Van Dijk Haaland 1v1? It got a lot of traction, a lot of people talking about whether it was good defending, bad defending, when he was backing up. What did you think of that?
Yeah, no, he backed off. and he backed off. If Haaland hits that properly, he scores.
You're in the camp of bad defending, or he should have done more.
I'm in the camp of he could have done better. The defending could have, in my opinion, if the fella hits that correctly, he scores. So to me, there has to be a point of engagement. The only reason is either bad defending or not, is it? Because if he just the fact that he didn't score doesn't make it a good defending, does it? So yeah. I would think that one or two things isn't far from me to cast aspersions on Van Dijk, who I think is absolutely fantastic. Oh, really? I would say that he probably needed to usher him wider earlier. And Haaland would be disappointed that he didn't strike the ball properly.
Outside looking in, it looks like England are in a wave of like development, players coming through over the last 5 years, probably. And you look at some of these young players that are now coming through, it looks that they're reaping the rewards of EPP and environments. But then again, when I look at that team that you were coaching in 1989, you talk about Cole and Crouch and Gerrard, and you're talking about world-class players. What we've seen the last 25 years, what of it? Has it been better environments? Are we in a time where England are producing more technical players, or what's your thoughts around that?
Well, if you actually go back through the England teams, well, you don't tell me Ray Wilkins wasn't a technical player, or the Frank Worthington, or Stan Bowles, or they've always had good players. All the England teams have always had good players. Well, like I said, you go to Brian Robson's and people like that. You know, you look at people like that back in the day. If you look at it, I think we're in a position now where we can compete with the best, with the best players. I think we have produced some fantastic players at this time, and I think that with what Gareth's done by assembling the players to actually reach the heights they've done, in a world where all the countries have top players, I think it's been a myth in the last few couple of decades that English coaches are not good, because of the style of play that happened in the 80s and stuff like that. And I think that the English coaches have been tarnished with the long ball game, which, you know, was prevalent back in those days. But I think there's always been good players in the national team, always.
There was a headline today just before we jumped on the Guardian, front page of the Guardian: when will the US produce a soccer coach who can gain respect in England? And I thought, God, I must ask Chris that one, having both experiences in America and experiences over here. What do you think about coaches coming over from America?
Well, they haven't done bad, have they? Let's be honest. We're saying when will they produce someone? Well, they've come and they've coached, and they've not. Bob and Jesse? You know, they've come, they've coached, they've had their levels of success and failures. No difference to anybody else. I don't see them any different to the coaches that have come here. You know, they've not been given war chests to go out and spend. They've come in difficult situations at different clubs. I think there's a bit of snobbery about it as regards the fact that the terminology that they use in America is different to the terminology that we use here. And, you know, I mean, I've coached, obviously, as you know, I coached in the USL against many American coach. I wouldn't be looking down my nose at them at any stage of the game.
Brilliant. All right, back on task. Let's move from player development to coach development. And I want to, you talk about the brilliant environment for coaches at Tottenham. And I want to ask you, when you went to QPR then, was that a cultural change? Did you have to build something there in terms of that coach environment, that coach culture?
I mean, look, QPR had a situation there where before we came, listen, I wouldn't want to say that those are as good or bad, because situations are you don't produce players, not only because you've got a bad coaching culture, it's probably the environment doesn't lend itself to that. But what we tried to do is, well, what we did was brought the formula that we had already had in at Tottenham. We brought it there because it's a style. It's not a, this is stick to this club, or it's something that I believe can be moved anywhere, as long as everybody's on page with it. You know, it's like anything. So it was a massive cultural change for a lot of people. We lost people along the way, which is, you know, what you do when things are changing. But we had some really good disciples there. You know, Paul Hall's now with the first team, Andy MP and Paul Furlong, and Micah Hyde. You know, all the senior coaches were on board. So it did help to influence the rest of the club. But also, I coach every day. So if people are not doing what we've asked them to do, then you take over and you do it. Because in the end, we forget the clients. The clients are the players and the parents. So it's like anything. If you're in a school and there's a teacher not doing the syllabus, you're not going to just allow them to do it. You're going to either remove that teacher or do it yourself.
How do you balance them between coach leadership, like quality control, like you're saying there, following the curriculum, delivering what needs to be delivered, and then not micromanaging people? Like, how do you get that balance right?
I don't think you do initially. I don't think you do, because like I said, it's like anything. If you've got a child and they go to a school, you're not going to allow we all talk about giving people freedom to you know, express themselves and all that. We forget that if you have a coach that doesn't do it for 3 years, that's 60 kids that have gone through his hands that have not had the right experience. That you wouldn't do that in a school. You wouldn't allow 60 kids to fail their exams, would you? You wouldn't allow it just so that the coach can gain experience. You wouldn't do that. So what you do is you try to help the coach get improve or stick to the plan, or you'd have to get someone who's competent enough to make sure that the players get what they need, which I think a lot of the times in coach development, we forget that's what we're working. We're working with players.
That element then is that, coach recruitment, is that something that you've been big on as well, going out and identifying coaches that fit a set of a culture or an environment?
Coach recruitment is very difficult in London. You've got 14 professional clubs, and in and around QPR, you've got Chelsea, Brentford, you've got Wimbledon, you know, you've got Fulham. So it's slim pickings. So a lot of the times people say, oh, can we get the best coaches? No, you can't get the best coaches. You get the best coach that can get to your training ground by 5 o'clock, who's got a B license and a youth award. That's what you get. Now, you hope that then that you get people that want to stick to the program. A lot of young coaches are boy racers, and a lot of young coaches want to move too quickly ahead of the game before they actually understand the game and how to coach. Because we forget, coaching is teaching. So knowledge isn't teaching. You can know a lot and not be a good teacher. So I would sooner the personality first and the knowledge second. So listen, they have to have a base knowledge. But I would rather someone who's got personality, can connect with the players, who has has a base knowledge, than someone with not a knowledge. I'd pick the personality over the knowledge all day long.
Yeah, very interesting, because we could be now entering potentially a new generation, which is like, yeah, more tech savvy, more knowledgeable, but also we're losing a little bit of that communication, that personality. I believe that. Would you agree?
I think 100% I'd agree. 100%. I think everything's tactical, everything's stats. And like I keep saying, people think, when I sort of talk like that, people think, well, you're a dinosaur. I said, no, but stats have always been there. People forget that. You know, there was a book called A Winning Formula years ago, written by Charles Hughes. And people, you know, if you look back at that book, people say, well, that's where the long ball came from. It didn't. It was a book of stats. How many times you do this? How many times you do that? That's what it was. But people choose to interpret it, the use of it, by saying, right, if you get the ball in the final third X amount of times, you're going to score. So let's miss the midfield play team out and get that. That stands in your interpretation of it. So there's always been stats. But people tend to think that the stats win the game. No, they don't. The stats and mistakes make you win the game. Very few games are won totally on tactical analysis. Very few. Most games are won because people have carried out the game plan better than the other one. In the end, it goes down to a 1v1. Someone crosses it, someone out jumps someone, they head it in. It's a 1v1 in the end. So I think you're right. You know, we're losing that little bit of communication.
Yeah, and then you merge that with, so I've never heard that phrase before, but I really like it. The boy racer, the coaches that are just in a rush to get the Premier League level, you mix that with the lack of maybe a little bit of communication skills or a bit of personality, and then you've got, it's not a great mix for a kid, that.
No. And they always, you know, one of the things that people tend to do, they'll always refer to the end product player. So you're trying to say, oh, right, we understand role modeling is important. So people will look at De Bruyne, or they'll look at, you know, as Xavi, or in the end. Yeah, great. That's where you want to get to. But that's so far away from your zone of proximal development. People don't scaffold the teaching. Who can you actually reach? If you're an under 13 and there's an under 14 that's excelling, you can reach him or her. You can reach that person. What are they doing that you're not doing, or what are they doing better than you? So sometimes we have to make sure that the players are role modeled by the people that they can actually get to. So their level of success is scaffolded incrementally over a period of time. Whereas sometimes we say, well, so-and-so done this run and then that run. I keep saying to people, Iniesta wasn't Iniesta at 12. People were talking to him about somebody else, you know, at that time. They might have been talking to him about Guti or someone like that. Do you understand what I mean? So they've got to understand that people develop into the famous person that they become. They're not that at that age. And a lot of players who become very top players weren't brilliant as kids. They weren't. They had to grow into it. So patience is massive when it comes to developing players.
Brilliant. All right, last one for you. Patience, yeah. Merging that formal education in an environment, you know, you mentioned the B licensed coach that you're trying to get there. Are you, I would imagine that you're trying to get that coach and filter or feed into the development of getting better, CPD events, kind of that self-development drive that you want in those coaches as well. Is that something that's a priority in that level?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at, say, a club like QPR, it's a great, great club, great fans, great owners. And obviously Les brought me in, you know, with his experience of what we've done at Tottenham as well. We were very much into the CPD as regards even the development squads, you know, the development part of the club, where we get the players, you know, they're not quite in the academy, but they're outside the academy. So we try to make sure, you know, for our recruitment, Gary Carson's there with Lee McCarthy, they integrated all the scouts into the development program. So when we had CPD, we'd bring them in. So they would look at, they would see sort of the type of players that we like, how they would fit into what we want. And I think that's really important in your CPD to bring everybody in. So every time there's a conversation, it's a common language. It's not just the language that people are talking about over there. So all the time that they that they do things that the players are sure about where, what our identity is.
And then I'm going to sneak one in again. Coaches that are dealing with resistance in that aspect of, again, you're well aware of the American landscape. A lot of listeners over here, coaches that are managing 30, 40 coaches potentially at a club, and they're saying, God, there's always two, three, four doing their own thing and all of that. What advice would you have for them to try and get that quality control and that culture right?
I think to start with, you deal with sugar, give them sugar. I think you try to see where they're coming from and why. But I think eventually when we went into to Tottenham, myself and John, we had an acronym, which you're probably going to have to fill the work, fill the bits in yourself, is FIFO. So that was it, really. In the end, it's a FIFO scenario, because you can't have one of the things that's been hard, even when you go and change something, if if everybody's happy, you're probably not doing the job right. Because if you've got 10 people and you've got two or three boy racers and everybody else is doing the job, they're not going to be happy. So you've got to think about the flock. If the flock is happy, that's where you need to be at. And the one or two that are not happy, no matter how good they are, they have to go. Because you get that one bad apple, and then that before you know it, everyone's not on the same page. And I always say to the coaches, if you're a school teacher, you can't just go into a school and just teach what you like. If the syllabus is teaching the Romans, you can't just come in and teach Henry VIII. You can't do that. You have to teach what the syllabus is. But lots of them, but you're killing my creativity. But I keep on saying to a lot of the young coaches, coaching isn't about how pretty the game looks or whether you win or what. Coaching is getting the best out of the people in front of you. So if the people in front of you are better at playing a direct game of football, then that's what you do. You get the best out of the people in front of you. Coaching is about just maximizing that person's potential the best that you can. And if you might have an idea, but you're teaching. And if people don't understand what you're doing, you have to find a way to make sure that they do it. And you have to also understand what their strengths are and what their capability is. That's why the program is a strength-based capability program. Do you know what I mean? What's your strengths and what you're capable of? And then that, because you're only ever going to do what you're capable of, aren't you? And most of it is back down to your strengths.
Brilliant. What a way to finish it. Chris, thank you so much. This has been the fastest move and interview I've ever done. I'm gutted. I wish it was always going to be longer. Fantastic. Thank you.
Well, listen, look, thanks a lot for inviting me. It's been an honor to be on.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. For more coaching topics, sessions, and resources, head on over to Coach Kernin on Facebook or visit the website at www.modernsoccercoach.com.